There we are. And I'm still here. This is Phil Taylor. This is the Taylor Report. By the way, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us out, taylor-report.com, and where you can hear previous programs. And I mentioned it about the halfway point. We'll talk to David Jacobs. There is also, David practices at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and he has some news for us of a new decision taken by that court to transfer an accused. So we're going to ask him about that. But primarily today we're going to talk to him about the fallout around the expiration of Václav Havel and the kind of international tension, the commentary, who's saying positive things and who is not. And so we will, that should be interesting. By the way of introduction, while we're getting Rhoda Sama on the line, I'm going to read to you. This is a press release from Geneva, and this is October. It says, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees on Friday said it would recommend the scrapping of refugee status for thousands of Rwandans by the end of June, as normalcy had returned after the 1994 genocide. Rwandan and UNHCR officials met in Geneva to discuss progress on comprehensive solutions for Rwanda refugees, a statement said. They agreed, quote, that a meeting of all relevant states and other actors will be organized in December this year, with a view to achieving increased voluntary repatriation and securing greater opportunities for local integration or alternative legal status, I wonder what that would be, for Rwandan refugees in countries of asylum, it said. The cessation of refugee status is one of the components of this strategy, and in this regard, UNHCR, that's the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, will recommend two states that they invoke cessation by 31st December 2011, effective on June 30, 2012. So that's a dramatic development. I think we're joined now by Rhoda Sama in Zambia. Are you there, Rhoda?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening.
Good evening, and I'm sorry we kept you up late, but we're glad to be talking to you. I just read to begin this a statement by a press release concerning the decision by the UNHCR to invoke cessation of the status of Rwandan refugees, and apparently in Zambia this is having a potentially a sudden or quick application. What is it you're faced with in Zambia with the refugees?
With the declaration by United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees that they are preparing to put a cessation on the Rwandese refugees, the Zambian government has come up with a very funny document of assessment where they actually go and do the assessment in the camp where the refugees are.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, out of the 500 that have been interviewed, not even one of them has passed the interview. Irrespective of the basis that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has given them guidelines of what to look for in the refugees. And most of the refugees qualify for them to be kept away from Rwanda, as it is known that it is not safe for them to go home.
Now, you said that the UNHCR is guiding the Zambians on how to do the interview and the content. Is that right?
Yes, they have given them guidelines
mm-hmm.
on what to look for. For example, if somebody was working in the government and they did have a problem with the Rwandese government, then they are supposed to be exempted.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody had maybe been involved in some government responsibilities that would actually cause them to have conflicts with the government, they're actually supposed to be exempted. But it looks like the Zambian government has its own interest right now, because they've set up a form where Rwandese are being interviewed, and I don't think any other country has had to go through this kind of interview, because this original interview is actually done by a group of lawyers. But after that interview, again, there's another interview that is done by the Department of Home Affairs. You know, a very complicated situation that none of us is actually comprehending what is happening here.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, yes, and we should point out that this is very peculiar that the Rwandans are being targeted for this kind of treatment by the United Nations, since there are Angolans and refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Both those communities are larger communities, but they're not being brought in on this matter, are they?
No, they're not being brought in. If you remember, Zambia during the struggle of the Southern Africa, the former president of Chakaunda did open doors to all about six countries in the region that actually had conflict. Mm-hmm. And none of those countries did I either ever hear were actually subjected to that kind of interview. All along, the talk of refugees has been voluntary repatriation. But unfortunately, I didn't wonder why the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees should have actually given instructions that each country can assess their cases according to how they feel like. Because the United Nations itself has a document, which is a UN mapping report of October 2010, and it's about 205 pages that they've done. And that report, they actually do come out with issues of what is on the ground in Rwanda. And they actually do know that it's not safe for anybody to go back to Rwanda, because the country has no democracy. There is poor respect of human rights. There is lack of political space. The media doesn't seem to have the freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, indeed. By the way, we're speaking to Rhoda Sama. She is with the a Migrant Community Board. She works in both Zambia and South Africa. She works as a volunteer with Amnesty. We do have a very ugly situation in Rwanda, and I thought that was understood. We have the Victoire Ingabire, who is a peaceful woman. She's never harmed anybody or threatened to harm anybody. She's in prison now for 1 year, and apparently she's going to have a long sentence. As you mentioned, journalists have been killed. Former leaders of the Rwandan government have been assassinated, even abroad. They've been murdered in other countries. What is the discussion in your region? Aren't the Zambian authorities aware of this?
I'm not very sure if the current government is aware of what is happening. It looks like there should be an underhand that has actually been used to influence the Zambian government. Because when I came from South Africa after this, the September elections, I didn't even know what was going on until I read it in a newspaper called The Post, where a certain Rwandese girl was actually complaining that even though she was at the university, she always woke up without knowing what was happening. So really, I didn't understand until I went back to South Africa, and then I was able to meet somebody who is Rwandese. And then they explained to me that there is actually a letter to that effect that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has decided to seize the issuing of asylum papers. So as I came back to Zambia, then I took an interest to find out exactly what is on the ground. And for the past 3 weeks that I've actually investigated, I found that there is documents written by different organizations. The domestic refugee services has actually written a document against people going back to Rwanda because it's not safe. And the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the United Nations itself has actually written a document. They've done investigations on Rwanda. which had not been concluded. A lot of organizations, even Amnesty, has actually come up with a report to show that Rwanda is not safe. Because the lady you talk about in Gavile Victor actually came from Holland, and immediately she landed in Rwanda. Just because she mentioned the word of that people were actually murdering each other, and you know, maybe not justifying who did it, she landed up in prison, and she was the president of an opposition party. And General Kayumba Nyamwasa was caught in South Africa in June 2010. And after he was caught, this caused the South African government to actually recall their ambassador from Rwanda. So it tells you that a lot of things are not in place, because the former close ally of President Kagame, who is an American right now, Rugagintwa Eugene, has actually come up with a document where he says, Kagame was involved in the 1993-96, the sitting down of the plane of the president. And all these things, actually Zambia is almost giving a death ear. From my point of view, it looks like the Rwandese are being persecuted like the Jews were persecuted in Germany.
Yes, they have nowhere to go, and it is shocking that an international agency would almost target them. I have a statement from the rector, the Right Reverend John Osmers of the Anglican Province of Central Africa. And he poses a lot of questions, which I wonder if they've answered him. He makes many of the points that you have made, and he says, you know, it's not the business of the government of Zambia to determine how you define a refugee. He said they can agree with the decision or not, but they can't change the definition.
Yes, it's actually like that. But you know, what is actually surprising is that Zambia, having been a home for more refugees than Rwandese, it surprises me that now they could be the very ones that would actually be able to put the issue of trying to send Rwandese to a place where it's not safe and be the first ones in the world. Because right now, Zambia, out of the efforts that they made on refugees, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has actually issued Zambians, 20,000 Zambians plus in South Africa, are living on asylum papers.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually being considered as refugees. And Zambia is a country that has never been at war. So you actually wonder to say, why is the United Nations High Commissioner playing double standards?
Yes.
Because if they wanted to actually have anything to do with refugees and maybe suggestion on them, they should have called on the African Unity to actually discuss with them and say, what solution do we have? If there are criminals among the Rwandese, we don't expect them to be sent to Rwanda. They should be sent to the International Court of Justice. If not that, the African continent should have taken responsibility of setting up another institution that should actually look on the case of Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. Well, indeed, you know, when the tribunal for Rwanda was established, they said the reason that they did it was because there would not be a possibility of getting justice within the state of Rwanda because of the nature of the differences there, and that's why they said they set it up. So they, even in its inception, was a argument for the status of these refugees. Let me remind people, we're speaking to Rhoda Sama. She's with the Migrant Community Board in Zambia and works also in South Africa and is a volunteer with Amnesty. You pointed out that Amnesty has itself said that refugees would not be safe. How many refugees are there, by the way? What numbers are we talking about?
The number of refugees in Zambia is approximately 6,000 that have been registered. But so far, a lot of them have been running away from the persecution, that we don't know whether they've landed in Angola or they're on their way to South Africa. Because when you actually harass people in that manner, you don't give them an option that they should actually be able to tell you where they're going to. So if you look at the possibility of these refugees, the 6,000 plus refugees living in Zambia, trying to settle themselves, they wouldn't be heading towards their country, Rwanda. They would be heading maybe to South Africa, which puts more pressure on South Africa, which is already overloaded, even with the Zimbabwean economical refugees. Because the Zimbabwean economical refugees, that almost 240,000 of them registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, they are not as threatened as the Rwandese, because those are only economical refugees who are able to cross the border on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. The South African border between Zambia, Zimbabwe and South Africa is open for 24 hours. And if you realize, big buses carrying almost about 70 people, 350 of them actually cross that border on a daily basis. That shows you it's not dangerous for Zimbabwe to go home. Mm-hmm. The South African government had given a deadline of December 2010 that was going to be the end of Zimbabwe using asylum papers. But the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees did not help them even implement that. While the South African government was trying to make people use passports, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees still went and gave Zimbabwe asylum papers. As a result, the South African government has even failed to implement the effort of trying to make Zimbabwe use their passports. Now, here is a group of 6,000 people compared to the 240 that they are giving in South Africa just to go and do business. 6,000 people who are life-threatened, and they have said, let them go home and be slaughtered at home. Because once you send them there, it's like they have kangaroo courts where somebody will just point a finger at you and say, you are one of those that actually cut them with a machete or anything. And you'll be gone. You'll be dead or you'll be in prison without trial. Yeah. And if you look at the media, like right now in Zambia, if you look at the media, there's so much propaganda on the Zambian television. But the question I'm asking myself is to say, what interest has Zambia really got? Is anybody getting paid by the Kagame government? Or is anybody benefiting something from them? Because there's so much propaganda on the national media of Zambia to show how progressive Rwanda has become. Mm-hmm. But on the basis that we have all these reports coming from Rwanda, everybody has stayed a deaf ear to say all is well, people should go home.
No, it's a very bizarre process, and I'm really glad we're talking to you about this. And I want to ask you, too, and this is Rhoda Sama in Zambia, what about this deadline? I understand that they said the December 31st this year would be the end of the cessation with implementation for June. But I'm told that in Zambia they actually intend to begin the implementation, that changing the status, at the end of this year. In other words, they're not going to give there's not going to be 6 months grace.
No, there isn't anything like grace, because already, having spoken to the commissioner, who is the commissioner in the Home Affairs, I've forgotten the name. Mm-hmm. Having spoken to him, he actually called me to say, if their documents actually get seized by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, they will become illegal immigrants. And then the Zambian government will have a way of arresting them and putting them in prison and start deporting them. Now, if you realize, Zambia itself, though having housed a lot of refugees, the only prisons that the country has are the normal prisons for the criminals of the country. They do not even have like a separate transitional center where probably you could actually say this is a transit home for illegal immigrants. So when you've actually arrested illegal immigrants, you actually go and subject them to a lot of things, illnesses, the HIVs, everything else, the tuberculosis. It's another death sentence. It's like sending people to Sobibor.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're actually trying to send people to a place where you stay. It's a place of safety. No. Mm-hmm. So if Zambia says right now, the interviews, tomorrow is the 27th, there's a camp in Mayuka, where they're actually going in to start interviewing them. They've given a lot of Rwandese deaths. I think that ends up to about the end of this month, the coming month, January, to make sure that they happen this thing. Or what the rush is about, I really do not understand, because we are talking about human life. When we talk about human life, my point of view is to say, if these people are criminals, let's identify the criminals out of the 6,000.
Yes.
And once we have actually identified the criminals, we can write to the international court, the criminal court, and say, these are the people that we are looking for. Then they take them away. And then we actually normalize or try and look at reintegration of these people that actually are vulnerable, not because they want to be vulnerable, but because they have no home to go to.
Yes. No, it's fortunate that there are advocates such as yourself. You're with the Migrant Community Board, and you say that Amnesty has spoken up, and I notice the Anglican Church and others. But at this point, international attention has yet to be drawn to this. Are there agencies that you would recommend, for example, that people go to inform themselves more?
You see, right now in the country, the situation is that it's only the government officials know what they are doing to the people. That's the reason why I have decided that on the 29th, I'm marching to the office of the Department of Immigration. I'm marching to the minister responsible for the refugees in the country. I'm actually going to give an ultimatum to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. But if the people are saying it's not safe to go home, we might as well slaughter them in Zambia. Before we send them, let's send them at their dead bodies, because then it won't make a difference how they land in Rwanda.
Mm.
And I actually plan to go and appeal to the first president that we make him an envoy, Dr. Kaunda, for him to go and talk to this government, for them to hold their fire. Mm. Because if these people have said it's not safe to go home, we can't send them home alive. If that doesn't work, because with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, I'll give them 1 month. If that doesn't work, then we have to call upon the international community to rise up and be able to see how they will actually be able to solve this problem amicably. Because persecution is the worst thing that actually happens in a human being. You have people spending sleepless nights. They can't even plan anything in their lives. On a daily basis, they wake up not knowing what they touch and what they don't touch. And most of these people from Rwanda right now in the country are actually conducting their own businesses. They are not criminals. They are not affecting the locals. I've tried to investigate on the local basis from the Zambians. They have not been affected in any way. There's no complaint of maybe the Zambians, the common Zambians, you know, the people that are rude, actually complain to say they are being bothered by Rwandese, like the South African, South African xenophobia. It's not there. So why is the xenophobia coming from the government? So this is the reason why I'm calling on the international community that let's rise up and save the community of people that want to live as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very glad that you're doing that. We're going to follow that. It definitely, I believe, will take steps such as the ones you're advocating. Rhoda Sama, we're very grateful for your time, and we're going to continue to follow this, and we hope we can talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you so much. I'll let you know on the 29th when I've actually done this match, and I'm giving a deadline to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I'm saying in 30 days' time, if they are still willing, let the Zambian government come and arrest all Rwandese. If by the month end they don't come to arrest them, we walk to their office and we ask the United Nations to actually slaughter them so that at least we can have a ceremonious departure for them to go and be buried in Rwanda.
Yeah. Well, Rhoda, thank you very much. And we're going to call you about that. Thank you. You put them on notice.
Thank you so much. Thank
okay.
You. I'm actually putting them on notice and I'm following you, sir. Thank you.
Indeed.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That's Rhoda Sama with the Migrant Community Board in Zambia. She's also a volunteer with Amnesty International, and definitely she has her hand on a problem which is quite dangerous and dramatic. I hope our listeners will continue to ask about this as well. I'm very pleased that the Anglican Church has stood up as it has in Zambia. We know there's a lot of political ferment in Zambia at the moment, and that there are many, many Zambians who support Rhoda's work, and so we should give them every hand we can. And we will, well, as I just repeated again, we're going to be talking to others there as well. We hope to be at some point talking to the Right Reverend John Osmer, who is also there and has done outstanding work. He certainly posed all the right questions very quickly when he heard that the shenanigans were going on in Geneva. He wanted to know, why are you singling out the Rwandans? You have Angolans, you have others. And he, of course, wasn't asking anybody to give them a hard time, but he says, why would you only pick one group? We have a few minutes before we speak to David Jacobs. I think it'd probably be a good opportunity. Phil, you have a labor story for us, and we'd like to know about that.
Well, and yes, we do, and it's an invisible labor story because, I mean, the press and their wisdom have decided to really play it down. But it is a major, major strike that is now 2 months old, and it affects the employees of private for-profit bus companies that are under contract to the region of York, and our York lies north of the city of Toronto. Its conglomerate includes cities like Markham and Richmond Hill and Newmarket. It is a major city in and of itself. It's run by a city manager. Nobody can name the mayor of York Region. I don't even know if such a person exists. And
the manager hasn't appointed the
right,
mayor.
Right. We remember back in the 70s when we had a city manager in Toronto, Paul Godfrey, and boy, did he manage us, right? Well, so York is run on the same kind of principles. And the city manager says, well, he's a free market guy, so this is a matter between his contractor and the union, and we just won't provide any bus service to anybody. And just to make it clear, the Amalgamated Transit Union, which is on strike against three different contractors, two different locals of the union, have offered from day one to settle the strike, which is about wages, by mandatory arbitration. They said, we will put our case in front of an arbitrator, and we'll live by what the arbitrator rules. Very often, of course, when it suits their purposes, politicians say, oh, that's what we're supposed to do. In this case, they say, no, we're not going to do that. You guys and our contractor can fight it out. And by the way, we'll save money at the region. And the effect, and there's 40,000 people who ride those buses, and this is a huge geographical area. This is not something where you can walk from one end of town to the other, right? 40,000 people now, including many high school students, of course, who don't have cars.
This has been 2 months?
2 months.
They've been without it.
So now the union has really been tough. So now, of course, all of the old tricks of the state come out. The city manager says, well, I'm neutral in this, but their wages they're asking for is too much, right? And now, of course, they go to their
own. What are his wages?
Well, yeah, I'm sure they're a little bit higher.
What are the wages they're in?
And then, of course, there is the issue that the local conservative MPP kind of baited the union one day and says, well, where are your picket lines? The union said, good point. We'll show you, right?
So
they've been picketing like mad for the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know, they are part of the 99%.
Right, that's right.
And the rest of us are supporting them.
And there's an old trick of the 1%ers that we know from labor history, the court injunction. So just the Christmas Eve gift for the ATU was the court injunction. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do the other thing. Everything you do is illegal.
And by the way,
the legal things you do, you can't do those either, right?
And if you want something, go to Santa Claus.
There you go. But what the fundamental issue is they would like to be paid in a similar manner to which the TTC pays its employees. But the problem is, for the region of York, you can't pay your bus drivers what the TTC pays if a private sector company has to make a profit. So the $6 or $7 an hour difference between what TTC drivers get and what these guys get is going into the pocket of a number of companies, one of whom, Veolia, and they're a subject for another discussion. They're an international company that is under a lot of pressure because of some of their activities in the Middle East. They're a French company, so they're digging their heels in because their right to make a corporate profit, of course, is more important than the services that the people need here.
You know? This is Phil Conner talking, and he knows what he's talking about. We don't have a labor press.
No, that's right.
And the way the communities know they have problems is when the mainstream press reports them. So you're saying they've just chosen to not report
it. They've just chosen not to report it. It when it suits their purposes, of course, like when the TTC strikers went on strike a few years ago when David Miller was the mayor. Well, of course, the Sun and the Post couldn't make enough noise about the crummy mayor, the crummy union, and the crummy everybody, right? In this case, they've just said, fine, this is a city that has done no serious urban planning in the first place, right? It's the worst example of unplanned urban sprawl. The developers get to decide how the city develops, and buses are an afterthought. But meanwhile, it's a city of over a million people. There's people who need buses, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just too bad for them. I mean, that's the attitude of the city, and that's the attitude of the press. And I don't blame these drivers. I mean, these guys look and
but Phil, I have to ask. I mean, now we're in the age of internet, et cetera. Are there any? We don't have a press, but how about labor sites where one could inform themselves?
Well, I mean, there are they do exist, but obviously they don't have the kind of muscle or the kind of attention.
Well, or professional journalists even, to people to carry to convey this.
But clearly, getting the message out is very important. And I have to say, with the suburbs, one of the problems I have to say is, I mean, when you look at Toronto and municipal politics, you have a lot of nasty people in municipal politics in this town, starting with our mayor, right? But we have a left on city council, and we have a left that is not afraid to speak up. One of the real challenges for the left, I think, is that it's got to develop municipally in York Region, in Peel Region, in Durham Region, and get onto the city councils and have a voice being heard.
Well, they have to apply to the city manager to get.
Well, the city manager ain't going to make it easy for them, right? But I think if I look at York Region, where you have people like Julian Fantino sitting in the House of Commons representing a portion of York Region.
You're behind the eight ball.
That's right. Where's the voice of the people? Where's the voice of the 99%? Yeah. It ain't
so
there.
Wind it up again, Phil, on that point. It is the Amalgamated
Transit Union, two different locals, on strike against three contractors who service portions of the region of York.
And at the moment, it's a total standstill.
Well, they've been negotiating the last couple of days informally for the first time in weeks, and that's as much as we can
do. Well, we're going to be asking about that again next week. That was Phil Conlon. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, and check us on the web at Taylor-Report.com. We're going to take a break, come back, talk to David Jacobs.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and the evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I bet I mentioned that. We're seeking to reach David Jacobs at the moment, and I'll just outline what I know about a couple of these matters. One is, we just spoke to Rhoda Sama in Zambia, and she's talking about the targeting, frankly, of Rwandan refugees there, and with the UN being actually the culprit. Now, there's been, at the ICTR, the International Tribunal, UN Tribunal, and Arusha, Tanzania, they've made a decision, that court, here they are on the last months of their status as a ad hoc tribunal, they're going to transfer one of the last accused to the nation of Rwanda, which is very odd, because in previous years, the Rwandan authorities have said, we want this one or we want that one, we want to put somebody on trial, and the authorities have said, at the United Nations, said no, and it had to do with such situations as having a presidential candidate sitting in a courtroom in manacles in a pink costume with her head shaved, and former generals of the Rwandan army under Mr. Kagame leaving the country because they say he's a tyrant, and finding themselves shot down in the streets in South Africa. Because of conditions like that, the tribunal has not been agreeable to transferring people. But in this instance, they say they will. And now we have David Jacobs with us, and he actually knows what he's talking about on this matter. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Of course, today we want to ask you about Vaclav Havel, but before we get to the fun part, you do have It's just a news situation. As far as I know, the tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, that is the United Nations tribunal, trying people accused of crimes in 1994 Rwanda, they have made a decision to transfer somebody from their jurisdiction to Rwanda. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I can tell you some about it. The name of the case is Uwinkindi. I believe that Uwinkindi was a religious figure in Rwanda, and the trial level of the court ordered that, on the request of the prosecutor, that his case be transferred to Rwanda for prosecution, and the trial chamber agreed and said that that would happen. Now, there had previously been a number of cases, I think about three, where the prosecution attempted to have cases transferred to Rwandan jurisdiction, and these were turned down by the court for a variety of different reasons, including that they didn't think that the Rwanda had an independent judiciary and or enough safeguards in any event for a fair trial. The trial level, the trial chamber, this time in Uwinkindi, decided to send him to Rwanda for trial, and the matter went to appeal. So the appeals chamber, which is the highest level, there's nowhere one can go beyond the appeals chamber, except, I suppose, to the Security Council of the United Nations. They upheld the ruling of the trial chamber. There seemed to be some indication in the decision that the court would be open to some sort of monitoring of the fairness of the situation in Rwanda. But beyond that, this has been somewhat of a shock to defense lawyers.
Well, you know, David, it sounds, if I can use a vulgar word, like politics. I mean, because what is the practical need for this? They have a tribunal. They've been functioning. They have precedent. They have what other than politics would cause them to need to transfer somebody, particularly at this stage of the tribunal's work?
Well, it's extremely disturbing to the defense. I mean, one would think that there was a reason why that the United Nations set up, or the Security Council set up a tribunal acting in Tanzania rather than Rwanda, separate from the Rwandan courts. I mean, the Rwandan courts have been prosecuting people for crimes. Yeah, and in fact, they still have, I think, over 100,000 people still in jail awaiting various trials related to what happened in 1994. I think those figures are right. And the defense has raised all kinds of concerns about the situation in Rwanda, not least that Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, appears to brook no dissent whatsoever. I mean, the woman who appeared to be the democratic challenger to his rule in the elections in the last year,
Ingabire,
she's been charged with genocide denial, as I understand it, among other things, simply for, as I understand her position, saying that both sides need to be called to account for things that happened in 1994. And then there are all these devastating stories of opposition figures or people who have fallen out with Kagame being assassinated or having an attempted assassination. One happened recently in South Africa, and then another one recently, a man also called Ingabire, who had been associated with Kagame and who had spoken out against him. Again, these were shootings which most people seem to think come from Kagame.
It wasn't your ordinary version of an assassination either. It was done with a machine gun, as I understand it.
A machine gun. both happened, I think.
Robbery.
Yeah, both happened in bars and restaurants, and there was no evidence of robbery. Nothing was taken. It was a professional professional hit, as they say in Hollywood. So.
Yeah.
So it's highly disturbing for defense lawyers, and I think it doesn't, you know, in terms of the court's own building respect for the administration of justice, it's certainly odd that they would seem to toss the ball to Rwanda when they have the jurisdiction and the mandate to deal with things themselves.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, by the way, if you could help us on that, when... They are winding up. This tribunal has a very short Do we have like a time frame that it'll be completed?
There is, but they do keep extending and extending it because there are cases that are still ongoing and cases that they haven't finished dealing with. So I don't think there are very many cases at the moment that are underway, but there are still cases being tried at the moment.
Hmm.
So I think the court is expected to wrap up something like 2013, but I'm not sure. They've had earlier deadlines, which they've extended because they haven't finished their work.
Maybe they want to establish a kind of volleyball thing with the government of Rwanda, so they send prisoners back and forth, and they can both go on forever trying people. We're speaking to David Jacobs, and thank you, David, for that information. By the way, you'd be interested. Next Monday, we're going to be talking to Peter Robinson, who was involved in all these things and is now at The Hague, so we'll follow up on this with him. But we wanted to ask you today about an article that's just been reprinted about, and you have to remind me who the author is, of evaluating Václav Havel and asking the question, why are people so... why do they make such a fuss over him?
Yeah, Michael Parenti, who's a U.S. writer, scholar, teacher, professor, PhD, who's a prolific writer, wrote an absolutely wonderful book on the assassination of Julius Caesar, and has written other books, reprinted recently after the death of Václav Havel a part of a book he had written in 1997, which is quite some time ago, and the book is called Black Shirts and Reds. It's about the collapse of socialism in Eastern Europe and so on. But in the excerpt from the book, which he titles now Must We Adore Václav Havel, and he says, you know, all of this sort of outpouring about Václav Havel being a great Democrat and humanist. I was going to say humorist.
Take a shot then.
There you go. They say he ignores a number of things. One is that he was a religious obscurantist. Two, he suppressed opinions that he didn't agree with on the left, and was profoundly dedicated to economic equality and free market capitalism. He said, in terms of being an obscurantist, he was opposed to political leaders who relied on rational cognitive thinking, and said the political leaders should show humility in the face of the mysterious order of the being, meaning, I suppose, the supernatural God and so on, you know,
wow.
And trust subjectivity and so on. And then he called for efforts to preserve the Christian family in the Christian nation.
There he fell back a little bit. When he got out of prison, the first week when he got out of prison, he spent with his mistress, and then he went home.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. So,
it's kind of like a Newt Gingrich or something. Maybe it's probably inspired by him.
Yeah. And he condemned Cuba for what he claimed were Cuban human rights violations, but was completely silent about, for example, El Salvador, Colombia, Indonesia, human rights violations in any other places which were more associated with the United States.
Well, and they're in the weapons business. I think, did the article say that he sold weapons to the Philippines?
He sold the weapons to the Philippines under when the Philippines was under dictatorship, and to the fascist regime in Thailand, and to General Pinochet. He didn't seem to have any problem with any of that. But on top of that, the great Democrat. In 1992, as president, he demanded that Parliament be suspended and that he be allowed to rule by edict so that he could push through free market reforms. He signed a law that made the advocacy of communism a crime, a felony crime, with a penalty of 8 years imprisonment. He signed another law barring communists and former communists from being employed in public agency.
Well, he also banned... politics in unions, right? You couldn't. Unions could not support political parties.
That's right, and not just that. The unions, which were perceived to be militant, had their property taken from them by the state and handed over to more compliant, what we would call company unions in Canada. And he also passed a law, make it a crime to prosecute hatred. But what he meant by that wasn't simply, the kind of anti-hate laws that we understand to be connected to human rights and such, but making it illegal to propagate national, religious, or class hatred, which, of course, would make the Occupy movements all illegal.
And he would nod and agree with you. Yes.
Yep.
He sounds like Fox News, doesn't he? I mean, that's... Which brings us back to, then, why is Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and, what's her name, the former ambassador?
Madeleine Albright.
Madeleine Albright.
Yes, and it wasn't just them, Sarkozy and Campbell from the UK. They all went to bow and pay homage to Havel because, obviously, he was a great symbol of destruction of the socialist system. And he came with all of this, all of these frills. He, liked rock and roll, entertained the Rolling Stones, and was allegedly a playwright. I guess he was a playwright.
He was a playboy. We're not sure about the right, but...
That's right.
He definitely was a playboy.
I mean, the problem is that's all...
He went around the palace on a scooter. That means he's a regular guy.
That's right. That's all we're told about him. He liked to wear jeans and all this sort of stuff. But the fact is that he was a blue blood from an extremely wealthy family, raised by chauffeurs and governesses and so on. Mm. He didn't actually like democracy. He said once that he didn't like democracy's cult of objectivity and statistical average.
Yeah.
He wasn't an environmentalist either. He didn't think that collective social efforts should be applied to solving environmental crises.
And yet we have, one of the reasons we're talking about this is people like, is it AltNet or somebody? And there's a whole flock of people doffing their hats and talking good old Vaclav. By the way, my understanding is that his stock had fallen tremendously. After all, he also is the guy who presided over the end of the Czechoslovakia. And I don't know whether you're right or wrong, but there were many people feel rather bitter about the way that went down. And I understand his stock, political stock, was quite low.
I gather is at the time of his death that the opinion polls showed him to be wildly unpopular in his home country.
Sort of a Gorbachev.
Yeah, very much
so. The lower they sink in their own country, the higher, the more Bill Clinton has to hold them under his hand, under his arm, and...
Well,
it's
very much like Gorbachev.
Or my sock puppet, or whatever you want to call it.
Gorbachev is also a guy who is fated by British and American pop singers and so on, who are
suspicious, don't you think?
Yeah, I guess that they're blinded by the appearances, but of course.
Well, it could be the money.
There's that too. But of course, the papers here don't tell us any more than he was a guy like that. Go in jeans and smoke cigarettes and regular kind of guy. But I mean, that doesn't tell you much. Well, what were his politics and what were his policies? We know that he was anti-socialist, and we know that, but we're not told absolutely anything else about him. I mean, he was a dissident, he was jailed and so on, but we're not told about his aristocratic background or the fact that he took properties from unions and from political organizations he didn't like. I mean, there were socialist youth groups. He just had the state take away all of their lands and properties.
Well, he brought the checks. Yes, checks in the NATO and provided checks to serve in, I believe, Afghanistan.
Well, that's correct. No,
which also didn't go over that well, actually, at home.
He supported the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War and so on. So His respect for human rights was very, 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 very selective. You can say about him that he very much respected the rights of the ultra-rich.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear that he respected anybody else's rights to free speech or anything else.
Yeah. Well, I think he picked the right way to get yourself to be rich and famous, how to get ahead. David, we're glad you called. By the way, there's something called a dandelion or something. What is that site where you found that?
Actually, I can't remember. You can find it on a number of websites at the moment if you want to.
Michael Parenti himself might have posted it. I mean, separately, huh?
Yeah, he has posted it himself, and he's posted it as what I wrote about him 15 years ago. But it comes, as I say, right out of his book, Black Shirts and Reds, which was published in 1997. I think it's still available. So I think if you just Google, find it, and if you Google Michael Parenti and Vaclav Havel, you'll find his article as well. It seems to be being widely reprinted across the net.
Yeah, well, it's certainly needed, and we're very glad you could summarize it for us, and we appreciate very much you giving your time.
My pleasure.
All right.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
David Jacobs. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Phil, you're looking, yeah. I see by the look in your eye that you have a Havel memory.
No, just as a little coda for that. One of the accomplishments that the former Czechoslovakia, the socialist Czechoslovakia, was never given credit for in the West was that in the time when they were the power in Czechoslovakia, they had very strong laws against racism, against the Roma people, who some people call gypsies, and they enforced them, and they had things like employment equity, preferential hiring, and stuff like that to integrate them into the workforce. One of the first things that Havel did was to get rid of all of those laws, and right on cue, all these little racist gangs organized themselves in Prague, and they went around beating up Roma. We have in Canada today refugees who've come here and have been granted refugee status,
yes,
who came from the Czech Republic because they are Roma.
And you recall, by the way, we see, you know, there are international networks of fascists, so that when one group of them, I recall, came, a group of our own homegrown fascists were picketed them and to try to drive them out. It's like here they are hunted, persecuted, and somebody picketing to see if they can get in on the hunt.
That's right.
That was an ugly.
They were being in a motel out on Kingston Road, and there was the Western Guard, whoever those guys were, outside walking up and down with signs saying to drive them out of Canada.
How brave! Any rate, now there was another gentleman who passed on that last week we spoke about, and I had the piece, and I recommend it once again. Alexander Coburn wrote about Christopher Hitchens. And I think I mentioned on last week's show that Norman Finkelstein also, he's had two, actually. By the way, we're living in wild political times. There's all sorts of wonderful commentary, and there's a lot of good fights going on, literal brawls. There's a good site called Mondo Weiss. Do you know Mondo Weiss?
Yes.
In New York?
Yes.
And very savvy writers. But they keep us abreast of things, such as Norman Finkelstein himself has come in for a little argument, because the issue of how to solve the crisis between the Palestinians and the Israelis, apropos of the West Bank, and there's a one-state, two-state argument. There's also the boycott arguments. And there was a conference, and Norman Finkelstein spoke, and there were comments disagreeing with him. They're all very friendly and very respectful. But certainly everybody understands the man has been absolutely heroic. But it's a benefit to have a look at that. I would urge people to go to Mondawi's site to follow it. But there was an element in this that about Hitchens is related to what I was just saying about Norman Finkelstein. Alexander Coburn pointed out in the Counterpunch for December 16, 18, you can get that on the web, that Hitchens had a trick of associating with famous people and becoming their acolytes, and then at the moment when he could get the most advantage, turning on them. And he had a friend who was one of our great scholars, the one of absolutely indisputable great scholars, Edward Said, whose body of work is substantial and whose opinions were never shallow, and he was never a smart aleck, as Mr. Hitchens earned a living being a smart aleck. But at any rate, he warmed up to Edward Said. Then, in the last years of his life, when Edward Said was suffering from cancer, Hitchens turned on him, way he had. And people need to remember that, because there's a lot of silly things being written about this guy. And he turns on a guy who did so much and contributed so much, not just in the matter of the Middle East. He's an authority on music. I believe you, Phil, could testify to that, because you also happen to be an authority. But to stab a guy and a friend in the back when he's suffering like that, it's got to be noted about this. That's why nobody ought to be making over this over the Hitchens. And we're leaving out a name, a very large name in modern letters, and that's Gore Vidal, who has, of course, he's quite old now, and Hitchens went after him after years of making sure he got invited to where he could stand next to Norman, Gore, rather. Mm-hmm. And the line I remember reading, and by the way, this is from the another victim of Hitchens, a guy named Sidney Blumenthal, who had worked for the Clinton administration, and Christopher Hitchens had provided an affidavit to prosecutors to try to nail his old personal friend, Sidney Blumenthal. Actually, Sidney Blumenthal could have ended up in prison. It cost him a lot of money to fight Hitchens and that affidavit off. I'm going to link this with Vidal. Blumenthal did write a book, and he got in his licks, and I thought they were very good. He said he always remembered that Hitchens wanted to make sure that he got invited and could hang out. And so if Blumenthal knew of any famous people, that he, Hitchens, would be there to chat them up. And he said, we went to, a couple times, he said, we went to lunch with Gore Vidal. And he said, what always stood out in my mind was that he referred to Vidal as master. Oh, master. Master this, master that, you know. And then, of course, when Vidal, I guess that kind of flattery is hard to do without at a certain point, befriended him, then, of course, he stabbed him in the back. Some of the nastiest things he wrote was when he thought, now I'm going to make something out of picking a fight with a friend. So what a low life is the way I want to put this. And I am just appalled that there are people who ought to know better who've been writing nice things about him. Now, of course, there are people who want him to write, like David Frum, he wrote something nice about him. That's very good. I like to think about that. I think that's what a wonderful closing period, that he thinks of himself as a great writer, and somebody says, oh, someone's brought flowers and lunch, and they who's that? And they says, David Frum, and he says, oh, my God, my life has been a waste. Frum wrote a piece where he retailed a story that's been going around to make Hitchens look good, and the story is about how Hitchens went to a Palm Springs private club, which was notoriously anti-Semitic, they say, no Jews allowed, etc., and that he, at the dinner table, ordered loudly, asked the waiter for a kosher menu, and that goes down allegedly as heroic. The problem is, you know, with those kinds of stories is somebody has to ask, and then what happened? There is no extra paragraph. There's nothing saying that a struggle took place to end this policy, so I have to assume that the policy went on. And I'll put it another way. It's going on right now, I suppose, because all he wanted was a little theatrical moment. And people repeat that. Frum not the only one to use that as the opening paragraph for a stupid account of the man. What people should say is, listen, let's fight anti-Semitism by all means. And if you know the name of the club, please tell us. And by the way, I wouldn't myself start with the waiter, because that's the least powerful person. That's somebody, a lot of people make fun of waiters and behave like boors who should know better. What's a waiter got to do with anything? Why don't you go to management? And so that's a story that people need to know. Anyway, his proper name is Snitchens. This has been the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out at taylor-report.com. And I want to thank Carol and Phil, and it's been great, and see you next week.